Hello, and welcome to this Ask GP podcast about autoimmune thyroid disease. I'm Kevin Barrett, a GP in Hertfordshire, and I'm talking to Marilyn Drews, a Professor of Endocrine Medicine at the Barts and the London NHS Trust.
Hello, Kevin. Nice to be here.
Hi, Marilyn. Autoimmune thyroid disease sounds really simple on the surface, and it's something that most GPs come across several times a week in our practice, and we think we know how to suspect, investigate, and manage it. But in your role, you must see more of the interesting aspects of it. So why should GPs take an interest in autoimmune thyroid disorders?
So I think, Kevin, actually, you've alluded to this already in the sense that with the increasing pressure on primary care not to refer out quite so much to secondary and tertiary care, quite a lot of autoimmune disease and particularly autoimmune thyroid disease is looked after in the primary care setting, unless there's something extremely peculiar or weird or wonderful about it. Of course, autoimmunity is increasing. 75% of cases are seen in women. People with autoimmune disease or who suspect autoimmune disease are becoming increasingly well educated about their health and about what may be going on with it, and have very particular questions to ask about what might be wrong with them and how they could best manage it, both for their well-being and for their future risk management. So for all those reasons, it's important that primary care doctors really understand it well. Of course, autoimmune diseases often run together, as you know, so you'll be the first person probably to see primary hypothyroidism presenting in a person whom you are already caring for with another autoimmune disease, and therefore you may be the first person to suspect it. And of course, you may well be the first person to whom a patient turns in a situation in which they have a medical emergency related to their autoimmunity, albeit relatively rare for hypothyroidism, but not impossible. So for all of those reasons, I think it's really important that GPs are well aware of both the basics and also the slightly more unusual aspects.
Yeah, so a wide range of symptoms. Patients often come to us saying that they think they have an underactive thyroid or something along those lines. But I guess with that range of things you talked about, what's the key symptoms that we should look out for in our patients? And I guess, are there any patients where we might not think about it, that we should actually be screening for it in an active way?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because of course we all learn from our textbooks about the classical presentations of hypothyroidism, weight gain and weight gain despite restricted eating, dry skin, dry hair, feeling lethargic, having some brain fog. Maybe, for example, somebody who has presented not with particular symptoms, but with new dyslipidemia or something like that, who's anxious about their thyroid. And often people who've got a prominent family history may consult you. But while those are the classical ways in which people present, you and I know that there are all manner of ways in which people present these days, both in terms of vague and subtle symptoms, but also, of course, an increasing number of patients are presenting because they've had thyroid function tests performed as part of a set of blood tests for some other reason, or because they have symptoms that don't necessarily fit the bill. And then it becomes a bit of a dilemma as to what to do, not least because for the slightly vaguer set of symptoms, sometimes it's not so easy to predict whether the correlation between symptoms and funny blood tests actually is quite the same as causation. So it is not uncommon in those kinds of circumstances with patients who've got atypical symptoms to have to couch treatment in the form of a trial of treatment for which they may feel better. But in fact, if they don't, it may be that their symptoms are not necessarily at the root of their problem. A good example of that, and one that I see a lot in consultations and we see a lot in online forums and things like that, is the patient with thinning hair, for example, for whom we all know that hypothyroidism is on the list of differential diagnoses, but it's vanishingly unlikely really to come up that way in the absence of any other symptoms. And indeed, when it does, treatment of the hypothyroidism frequently does not actually improve the hair loss with which the patient first consulted. So that would be a kind of a good, but not the only example of a situation in which it comes up, but it may not actually have been at the root of things. By and large, most of the guidelines around would suggest that patients should at least have a presenting symptom in order to screen them. But actually, across international guidance, there's rather a difference around the assertiveness with which it is suggested that we should do case finding. So the American guidelines are all about very, very assertive case finding, even if there's a possibility of thyroid dysfunction. But not all other countries feel the same. There are, however, a number of populations in whom screening and surveillance is particularly important. And I suppose I'd list among those women who are concerned about subfertility, or who perhaps have got autoimmune disease in the family or thyroid disease in the family and who are planning a pregnancy, women in whom there's a personal history or a family history and who are in early pregnancy even without prepartum counselling, women who are postpartum who are symptomatic, and that might be with postpartum depression, for example, or simply with lethargy, for which, as you know well, the postpartum period has lots of reasons for lethargy, but somewhere in there can be hidden postpartum thyroiditis and hypothyroidism. Anyone who's had previously abnormal thyroid function tests or who's known to have thyroid autoantibodies is at greater risk of developing formal biochemical hypothyroidism, and therefore it's reasonable to have them under intermittent surveillance. And then patients who have other disorders in which hypothyroidism is overrepresented are also worth thinking about in terms of surveillance and case finding. I'd given as an example, for example, patients with type 1 diabetes in whom thyroid disease is seen in around up to 10% of people, patients with celiac disease in whom hypothyroidism is increased, patients with Down syndrome who often can't give a clear account of their symptoms, but who, if we go looking, maybe 10 to 15% of them will have positive thyroid autoantibodies and therefore are at marked risk of developing hypothyroidism. Patients who come to you with mood disorders or dementia sometimes have hypothyroidism under it. And a remarkably high percentage in some studies, actually, of patients with difficult to manage obesity turn out to have hypothyroidism. So actually the patient who says, "I think it's my glands, doctor," sometimes it is. New hypertriglyceridemia likewise. And of course, a bunch of patients who are on medications that can disturb the thyroid require surveillance and case finding, which might happen in the secondary care setting. So for example, when patients have newly been started on a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. But lots of patients are on chronic medicines long-term that can perturb the thyroid, like amiodarone or lithium. And they too will need intermittent thyroid function testing for fear that they may become hypothyroid.
So there's lots of things where thyroid function tests should be checked. And I remember, well, when I go into my practice and open my in tray in the morning, there are often dozens of thyroid function results to look at as well. And most of them are normal and it's straightforward, but some aren't normal. And which bit should we get worried about? Is it the T4 bit, the TSH bit, or when should we be focused on one rather than the other?
Well, it depends a little bit on your practice and what blood tests you're empowered to request, because I know that some practices are only able as a first screen to check for TSH. Other practices are able to check a full thyroid screen, which would normally be TSH and T4, and sometimes inadvertently lands you with a T3 that you may not have required. So some of the time you have to work with what you get. But the most helpful measure of all of those things is the TSH, on the grounds that it's the most sensitive measure of how much thyroid hormone the cells in the body are seeing. If you like, it's the thing that changes the thermostat that drives the thyroid. So if a patient is developing hypothyroidism, the TSH will rise, and it will rise even in the early stages of hypothyroidism, in which the high TSH drives the thyroid to work a little harder, and in which therefore the T4 levels will be normal, a situation which you might call compensated hypothyroidism if the patient has some symptoms, or subclinical hypothyroidism if in fact they're asymptomatic. But you'll see it in the TSH even if the T4 is normal, and vice versa of for hyperthyroidism. And really, it's only necessary and useful for the most part to go on and look at the T4 once you understand what the TSH is doing. There are a couple of exceptions to that that I'll come on to in a second. The T3 is really only of value at all in a situation in which the patient is hyperthyroid, so the TSH is suppressed. A patient who has an elevated TSH, which is, of course, the subject of our discussion today, hypothyroidism, knowing what their T3 is doesn't add anything to what you do about them, because really the T3 is the intracellular active hormone converted from the T4. So the circulating T4 is the sort of second most important thing after the TSH. The times that there's an exception, if you like, where the TSH might be normal, even in the setting of an abnormal T4, the classical one really is pituitary dysfunction, of course, where the TSH can't go up because the pituitary is incapable of causing a TSH rise in the setting of inadequate thyroid hormone levels. And certainly in patients who you are looking after, who you already know have pituitary dysfunction, it's really important not to rely on the TSH, but to check out the T4 too. And then there's a range of situations in which thyroid function tests maybe don't make perfect sense. So a TSH that's high in the setting of a T4 that's also high. And that's usually a puzzle for the endocrinologist. We love those kind of things. So if it doesn't make sense, it's good to ask. There are all kinds of situations, including medicines that the patient is taking or alterations in the way in which they are taking their medicines, that can be at the root of funny thyroid function tests. But for the most part, first line and most important is your TSH measurement.
Yes, I can think of a couple of patients of mine who've had pituitary, either pituitary tumours or pituitary surgery or those sorts of things. And it is a little bit confusing with those patients sometimes. But yeah, that's the problem. Those are the main exceptions to think about when we're looking at the T4 rather than TSH level. So thank you.
Yeah, and it's particularly important because sometimes your lab result will come with a rider that says what they think you should do. And of course, the lab don't have the information you have about the clinical status of the patient. So you're by far the better judge in a sense of what that TSH means.
Yeah, that's true. And sometimes the information that we write in our pathology forms doesn't get translated and doesn't end up coming back to us either. So if we're looking at other people's results, it's quite tricky sometimes.
Yeah, indeed.
So I was thinking about some typical patients that we see. So we get lots of patients that come to us saying that they feel fatigued. And I was always taught that the three things you think about are anemia, depression, and hypothyroidism with that as well. Particularly patients with family history. And I know that that's much more likely to be an issue in men rather than women, if there's a genetic part with that as well. But I'd like to hear a bit about the sort of genetics of it as well, if that's okay. And obviously we're still in the world of COVID, and with our post-COVID clinics and post-COVID support services that are going on as well, we're always taught to exclude alternative underlying diagnosis or other disorders, including hypothyroidism. But again, patients come back to us with borderline results for all sorts of different reasons. So what do we do about those that have borderline results?
Okay, so I'll take the first one first and the second one second. So as far as genetics goes, for the most part, there's not a direct line, a direct inheritability of hypothyroidism. What there is, of course, is a heritability of autoimmune tendency. And therefore, it's always worth asking patients about thyroid disease and other autoimmune diseases present in their family history. The reason we think about it more in men than in women is only really because autoimmunity by definition is overrepresented in women. So something like 75% of patients with autoimmune disease will be female. For all kinds of interesting, potentially complicated and sometimes controversial reasons that may relate to estrogen, that may relate to postpartum and the sensitization of the female after the delivery to the cells of the fetus and all kinds of interesting hypotheses. But essentially, because women are more prone, we're primed to think about them anyway as having the potential for autoimmune disease. When a male patient turns up, by definition, because autoimmunity is less common in males, the likelihood of autoimmunity being part of the pathology, it has to come to the forefront of our mind more frequently. And hypothyroidism is kind of more likely, therefore, as an association with other autoimmune conditions in the male with hypothyroidism, because he wasn't likely to have autoimmune tendencies compared to the females in the first place. So we have a slightly higher or a slightly lower threshold, I guess I should say, for thinking about whether there's concurrent Addison's or concurrent celiac or something like that. With respect to the borderline issue, of course, that happens a lot. And it, I guess it goes back to what I was saying right at the beginning about the fact that there are some patients who have a clear set of symptoms, a clear set of signs, and a clear set of blood tests that go along with those. But then there's the group of patients who have rather more vague symptoms, perhaps no signs, and a rather borderline set of blood test results. And it's we feel less confident drawing a line between the two. And quite often, of course, we'll get a patient who has definite abnormal blood test results, perhaps a TSH of 16 or more, who says they've got no symptoms at all. You've done the test for some other reason, but they've got no symptoms at all. And then you may feel that you're in a bit of a dilemma about whether and when to treat. And that's when we get into the realms of health promotion as well as and risk prevention, as well as symptom management. So I think it's probably fair to say that a patient who is symptomatic with definite biochemical hypothyroidism, so an elevated TSH and a low T4, is someone who you are likely to treat. A patient who has even indefinite symptoms, but definite biochemistry, particularly if it's sustained, is someone who you're also likely to treat. The situation that concerns people is more the subclinical compensated set of results, where the TSH is elevated, but the T4 remains normal. And the question is then what to do. And again, from reviews of the literature and available guidance, if the TSH in that situation is greater than 10, the recommendation is usually to treat. I say usually because I don't think any situation is black and white and the patient's view is also relevant. But if the TSH is greater than 10, it's appropriate to treat for two reasons. Firstly, because those are the patients who've got the highest rate of conversion to true hypothyroidism in the coming months and years anyway. But secondly, the impact of that elevated TSH on cardiovascular risk, particularly via dyslipidemia, is sufficient that intervention appears to be beneficial. Where the TSH is above the upper limit of the reference range but below 10, in the presence of any symptoms, I would still recommend treating, but I'd couch it with the patient in terms of a trial of treatment, so that if they have some symptoms and those symptoms improve, absolutely it's appropriate to continue. But if they have no symptoms or they feel no better and they do not wish to continue, then it's reasonable to stop and monitor for a period of time and see what evolves. And sometimes subclinical hypothyroidism has a slightly undulating course and never really goes anywhere. And so if there's nothing to treat, then it's not necessarily obligatory to do so.
Just checking that sometimes we see patients who have we only have one set of thyroid function results in their notes and it can be abnormal or borderline. What's your feeling about how often we should repeat those and when we should repeat them in order to actually make that more concrete diagnosis of borderline hypothyroidism? But at what point should we just, have enough evidence to decide whether to treat or not?
Yeah, I think if there's one set of blood tests and there's symptoms, that's reasonable. I think if there's doubt or there are no symptoms or the results are very marginal, then it would be reasonable to do one recheck, perhaps in 2 or 3 months, and then decide what you're going to do. If the decision is to treat, then once you've started treatment, there's no value in retesting thyroid function tests for at least 2 months. Because although the T4 will start to come up sooner than that, it takes a good 6 to 8 weeks for the TSH to equilibrate. And what is a bit like turning a super tanker, you don't want to act too early to further increase or to draw down the dose when your TSH hasn't quite bottomed out at the level that it's going to. If you decide not to treat and you decide simply to monitor, then perhaps another test in 6 months to see which direction the wind is blowing. And then thereafter, it depends a bit on the TSH. If the TSH is very elevated, another 6 months would be reasonable. If the TSH is super marginal and there's no symptoms, you could leave it as long as a year with the patient coming back on an SOS basis if they didn't feel well. What's not particularly helpful in terms of prediction is the titer of the TPO antibodies if you have them. So knowing that it's autoimmune is helpful because that gives you an indication of the clinical course. So maybe 5% of patients with subclinical hypothyroidism and positive TPO antibodies will become formally hypothyroid without treatment per year. But the titer of the TPO antibodies doesn't help you decide which group are going to go and which group are not going to go. So I think once you've decided to monitor, you can monitor.
Okay, that's really helpful. I think the yes, we do get lots of patients that come to us and they want an instant answer and they want to compare their results with their online peer group as well. So that's really clear. Thank you very much. So I guess when it comes to prescribing, so we've decided to actually give the patient a prescription. You know, like with lots of things, we just give them a prescription and off they go. But life isn't as simple as that, particularly with medications, including thyroxine. So what should we actually be telling them about their disease and the prescription we've just given them?
So I think the first thing to be telling them about their disease is that it is usually, not always. So for example, if someone's just had a thyroidectomy, we replace like with like pretty quickly because they're used to seeing plenty of thyroxine. But in a patient who perhaps has come to you with vague symptoms over a long period of time and borderline or mildly abnormal thyroid function tests, it's not clear how long they've been unwell for, and therefore it is appropriate to start at a small dose working up to the dose that you think they are likely to require, allowing for the fact that their own thyroid may still be doing some of the legwork. So you might look at them and sort of know that an estimate, if they were not producing any thyroxine of their own, would be that a kind of rule of thumb final dose that they might need is something in the order of 1.6 micrograms per kilogram. But firstly, that's very vague. Secondly, that's not, it's all very well in a population, but not necessarily in an individual. And thirdly, you don't necessarily want to throw a full replacement dose at somebody who does not require it immediately, because they may well get some palpitation type side effects, particularly if it's actually giving them more than they require. So I think it's helpful for them to understand that this is a process, and also that during this process, their own thyroid may continue to function or may continue to deteriorate in function. So they may end it, it's so that it's not the fault of the doctor that the dose is fluctuating. It's a necessity as their own thyroid function alters. Because understanding that's quite helpful to the patient, as is understanding what you're looking at and what the TSH means versus what the T4 means when you're interpreting what happens to them next. They should be told to take their medicine ideally first thing in the morning before they eat or drink anything, usually half an hour before food, because that is the time that it's best absorbed and that is the point at which there is least interference from other agents in the diet with respect to absorption. But it's also helpful for them to understand that their medication is a replacement hormone that's doing the job of, but is in all other ways pretty much similar to, the hormone that their own gland was making. It's not a pharmaceutical agent per se, and therefore if the dose is appropriate, and they're not necessarily expecting all kinds of side effects that they may fear. It's helpful for them to know the thing I just said about the 6 to 8 weeks before the TSH normalizes, which explains why the monitoring takes a period of time and why blood tests are not done immediately after they've started the medication. And it's also helpful for them to know about, if they're following the advice and not taking the medicine with food or with other medications, that's great. But certain medicines do interfere with thyroid hormone absorption. The classical culprits are PPIs, so omeprazole and lansoprazole and things that interfere with stomach acid production, and also iron supplements that bind the iron even before it gets as far as absorption. So those things are kind of useful to know. It's also useful to know that if for some reason it's impossible for them to remember to take the tablet first thing in the morning, there's no reason not to pick another time if that's what they're going to stick to. So reliability is sort of advantageous over a highly unreliable first thing in the morning opportunity. But first thing in the morning is the time you're least likely to cause some other absorption issue.
Thank you. Yes, I generally tell to my patients, because I have some who are more pedantic than others, and they say, I set my alarm at 5:30 every morning and get up and take it. And actually, then it can be quite disruptive to their lives. But I think for the rule I always go by, as long as they're doing the same thing every day and having the same sort of breakfast, then the body sorts itself out and the lab results tend to equalise.
The truth is that the half-life of T4 is so long that doing the same thing for the same time every day sort of helps because it fits in with life and it means the absorption will be similar, and also helps with the reliability of taking it. But if they miss a day, they won't feel it. And because the half-life is so long, even if they ended up taking it the next day with the tablet the next day, that would be fine too. And that's sort of the basis upon which people who have great difficulty in taking their tablets or remembering to take their tablets, or who perhaps have got learning or memory issues that make it impossible to oversee, sometimes weekly direct observed therapy, which is not a thing I'm advocating here, but is done occasionally in extremis and actually doesn't really cause too much of a perturbation in the thyroid function test levels because the half-life is so long.
Gosh, I'd never heard about that. I think the key message though is try and get the patients to do the same thing every day, and that's the better way, because then it helps the compliance. Because patients on thyroxine are often on multiple other medications as well. So, but it's not quite as crucial with the diet as things like warfarin and Brussels sprouts and those sorts of green leafy vegetables that can have a day to day impact on it too.
Yeah, it's more what you take physically with it than what you have at other times of the day that are the issue. Absolutely right.
Can I just ask about an annual review? Because if a patient is only on liver thyroxine and they come to us because they have the prescription reviewed you, what are the things we should be checking, as well as obviously the blood results? What would you ask a patient in your clinic?
So I think it's a really good opportunity for checking in around concordance with therapy, because it's a very easy tablet to forget. It's a very easy medication to allow to drift, because you often don't feel it when you miss a dose. And it's the sort of archetypal medicine that patients maybe forget to take, and then in a last minute panic in the run up to an appointment start to take. And that can actually give some fairly characteristic but slightly peculiar blood test results. So if the blood test results are normal and you check in with the patient and they're very happy taking their meds and all is well, but actually if the blood test results are in some way unusual or don't make sense, it's a really good opportunity to understand how they're taking their tablets and perhaps what has changed in the last year. It's a good opportunity to work out whether their symptoms have been improved by taking the medication. There are a number of patients who feel significantly better on levothyroxine replacement, but there are a number in that sort of slightly fuzzy category right at the beginning who we started and thought we would, you know, job done on, but in fact, the symptoms weren't necessarily wholly attributable to thyroid dysfunction. And we may need to be thinking about other things. Maybe there's some other autoimmune diseases burgeoning that actually are at the root of some of the symptoms that haven't quite gone away, for example. And it's also a good opportunity, particularly for young women of reproductive age, if they haven't come to you first, to talk to them about preconception planning and optimizing their thyroxine dose and ensuring that all is well heading into a pregnancy, and giving them some advice about what kinds of monitoring they might need during a pregnancy. Many women require a dose increase in their thyroxine during a pregnancy, for example. And because hypothyroidism that's not optimally managed prior to a pregnancy has got some sort of adverse outcomes, both in terms of maternal health and delivery, and in terms of fetal health and subsequent development, it's a really good opportunity to make sure that the dose is right and that it's being taken well and that everybody kind of knows what to expect.
Yes, so compliance is the key with that then. And that's interesting about those blood results, because I often scratch my head sometimes with that, but I think I need to ask the patient what they were doing, not necessarily in a week or two for the bloods, but in the month or two before they had the bloods.
Both, and often the answer becomes clear.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned pregnancy there as well. I've heard all sorts of different things over my years as a GP. I think when I first started, every single patient who was thinking about becoming pregnant had a thyroid function check done, particularly those who had struggled to get pregnant for a few months, you know, let alone the year that we go by these days. I've also heard talk that maybe GPs should be increasing the thyroxine dose before patients seen in an antenatal clinic, and vague rules of thumb that I've heard is we should increase dose by 25%. Is that something that is actually recommended, or should we just not touch it until they've been seen by the obstetric services?
So I don't think you should take the view of not touching it no matter what, because sometimes it takes time for a patient to get engaged with obstetric services. And the first 12 weeks of fetal development are important, and being euthyroid in that period is important. So I don't think you are mandated to take a hands-off approach. I think if a patient, I also don't think at present there is necessarily any recommendation for case finding in all women who are thinking of a pregnancy. So there's no suggestion that we should do thyroid function tests in all women who say they're planning a pregnancy. But if there is a hint of a doubt, for example, subfertility or difficulty getting pregnant, or symptoms, or an autoimmune family history, or a previous set of abnormal or borderline thyroid function tests, or for some reason a patient who knows that they've got positive antibodies, all of those things would be, I think, fair game for a preconception thyroid function test, because it is one of the situations in which I would advocate treating a borderline TSH to bring it down to at least within the reference range, if not to in the lower half of the reference range, simply because of what we know of the impact of thyroid status on fetal neurodevelopment and actually childhood IQ, for which the signal is very, very small. So certainly if a woman turns up and she's already 12 weeks pregnant and her thyroid function is not optimal, I don't think there's a reason to panic her or to allow her to sort of be swayed by scare stories. But on the other hand, we know enough about sort of IQ points, and we also don't know if the intervention helps, but what we do know is women who go through pregnancy with subclinical hypothyroidism, when we look at sort of IQ points in the seven-year-old baby later, there's a statistically significant difference. Now, a few IQ points in a population shouldn't constitute a scare story, but if we can get things right early and take guilt and anxiety out of the equation, then for sure we should do so. And women who know that they are on thyroxine already, you know they're on thyroxine, absolutely it's reasonable to check their thyroid function tests prior to or as early in pregnancy as possible. And I certainly would think it reasonable to adjust to at least a normal TSH as soon as you can, allowing for the fact that a dose increase may be required later, and certainly obstetric services could take that on. Actually, the approach is a little different in pregnancy. So some physicians would suggest an automatic increase of 50 micrograms during a pregnancy. Others will monitor thyroid function tests closely as they go. So I think it's completely appropriate to individualize it to where your patient is starting from and what other comorbidities there may be. But I don't think we necessarily should say it's not for us, someone else should think about it. And that people can always advise over the phone if there's concern about what to do.
Yes, I think that's really useful advice, and telephone advice and advice and guidance and email and various apps and bits and pieces that are around the country are actually very useful for that. So yes, absolutely. So that's good. Actually, we shouldn't be afraid of thyroid disorders in pregnancy then.
The reference ranges for TFTs do vary a bit trimester by trimester, and the lab don't print those for you. So you get a trimester specific reference range. So sometimes thyroid function tests can be a mildly abnormal. Usually the reference range is down. So actually the lower end of TSH is normal, particularly in the early stages of pregnancy. So it's worth knowing that. You don't need to always panic that you have a patient who's over replaced or hyperthyroid on your hands.
Thank you, Marilyn. Now, I've saved a couple of potentially tricky questions for the end, I'm afraid. The first one really is about liothyronine, because we've got a few patients who are either still taking it or ask us about it as well. I know that the British Thyroid Association and the Specialist Prescribing Service have produced guidance about this, but as an endocrinologist, can you summarise this for us and just remind us of those key messages that we need as GPs when we're talking to our patients, please?
Yeah, okay. So I'll talk about three separate things, not all of which have equal voice in the guidelines that you're referring to. So the first bit, as you say, is patients who historically have been prescribed liothyronine or T3, which nowadays is no longer really routine practice. It used to be something that got prescribed frequently, for example, in patients who were on thyroid cancer surveillance, because it has a shorter half-life, so it's easier to withdraw and restart. But both cost, half-life, and lack of particular benefit reasons, it's no longer a standard therapy. So the advice, therefore, for the most part, for patients who are on T3, is to switch them to T4. And T3 has been removed from a large number of formularies, both at primary care level and at hospital level. That switch, by and large, should be dose for dose. So roughly speaking, 20 micrograms of T3, I think the guidelines say 25, it depends what formulation you have, but roughly 20 micrograms of T3 is roughly equivalent to 100 micrograms of T4. For the most part, therefore, a switchover, potentially with a bit of overlap, because the T3 will come out of the system quicker than the T4 will get into the system, should end up with the patient on an appropriate dose of replacement. And after 2 months, as we said before, 6 weeks to 8 weeks on the T4, you can recheck the thyroid function tests and make sure that the TSH is where you want it to be within the reference range. And if a further small adjustment is required, then so be it. So switching from T3 entirely to T4 should be fairly straightforward, and the guidance is all in there. There's a bit around patients who are taking or who ask to take a combination of T4 and T3 therapy. So the addition of T3 to their T4 for the purposes of improved symptom control. So patients who say, I don't feel well enough on my T4, I know my blood tests are fine, but I don't feel well enough, and I've read that T3 will make me feel better because maybe I'm not converting it adequately. And the guidance on this has been a bit like a pendulum swing. It used to be very unclear, then it was very, very clear, and now it's become a little more blurred again. When it was very, very clear, the clarity suggested that there is no advantage in any randomized control clinical trial published to date for the addition of T3 to T4 therapy, and therefore it should not be prescribed. And that was clearly outlined by both the British Thyroid Association and the American Thyroid Association, and made it very, very straightforward, actually, for primary care physicians to point to the guidance and be clear. Now, not necessarily with any change in the available evidence, the guidelines have been sort of slightly softened to say something like in most cases or under most circumstances. And I think that's sort of to cover the theoretical possibility that were we to have more stratified trials in which we were stratifying patients by things we don't know about yet, like genotype or deiodinase or something like that, maybe there would be a subgroup of patients who might benefit, but we just don't know it yet. I still don't think that that provides license in any way to add T3 to T4. I don't think the evidence is there yet, but it certainly explains why patients are a little keener to rediscuss it. I don't think it's something that really is appropriate to start doing in primary care, and I think it's something for discussion between a patient and an endocrinologist. There are very limited circumstances in which it might be something that's suitable or beneficial. But what's really important, if that is going to happen, is the monitoring, which becomes, of course, much more complex because you can no longer use T4 in any way because the T3 isn't measured within the T4 and has a different half-life, and measuring the T3 is unhelpful because of its short half-life when a patient is taking T3. So I think it's not something really that should be initiated in primary care, but I mention it here because you may get some queries from people who understand that the stringency of the guidelines appears to have been rewritten in a slightly softer way. That then, of course, leads on to patients who say that what they would like to take or what they have accessed for themselves over the internet are natural thyroid hormone preparations, which are preparations usually made from animal thyroid, so crushed up gland, that because they're made from crushed up gland, provide a mixture of animal T4 and animal T3. So it's a bit like saying, I want to take T4 and T3. I very much suggest that those are not also initiated in primary care for exactly the same reason. Actually, the ratio of T4 to T3 in such preparations is not particularly physiological in terms of what should be circulating in the patient. It's not human thyroxin, but also, and perhaps more relevantly, none of these preparations is made to good manufacturing practice and none has been trialed to good clinical practice standards. And what that means is that the uniformity batch on batch can be extremely variable, and therefore the doses of T4 and T3 that the patient ultimately absorbs can be rather variable. If a patient's committed to the medication and is unwilling to change it, it's worth being aware that for safety, of course, they still need the adequacy of their replacement monitored, and the target should still be a TSH within the reference range, but the T4 measurement and the T3 measurement, just as patients on a conventional mix are unreliable, is also unreliable in this setting. So all you've got to go on is the TSH. So that sort of covers all the different ways in which a patient might turn up on liothyronin for you.
Thank you. That's really clear. I think it's really helpful to very clearly state that we should not be initiating liothyronin in primary care, and that the over-the-counter preparations, we shouldn't support our patients in taking those. We shouldn't recommend our patients take those. Again, advice and guidance and email and telephone discussions and apps and things help us to have those discussions with consultants to actually get that firm advice. So thank you.
And there's one other bit of guidance that's not liothyronin related, but also is prescription related, that it might be worth us mentioning too, which is, of course, that even for patients who are on conventional levothyroxine, levothyroxine by and large it turns up as a generic preparation. And for the most part, it doesn't really matter which patient is getting which preparation. They broadly absorb what is in the preparation and the thyroid function tests stay as they should be. But you may have come across particular patients who say that something has happened and their medicine has become ineffective, or something has happened and having been stable on a dose for a long period of time, they're starting to get symptoms of over-replacement. And of course, once you've thought about all the usual things, like maybe they've developed celiac disease, or maybe they're taking the wrong dose, or maybe they've started taking an iron medicine at the same time and their absorption is different, it's always worth thinking about the preparation that they're actually ingesting. The classic one is someone who's become lactose intolerant and a preparation that's got lactose as the excipient. But batches do vary by a tiny amount, and preparations can vary by a tiny amount. And new guidance now that's available online, sort of government guidance, suggests that where you do feel, and it's pretty rare, but where you do feel that a patient is symptomatic when they are prescribed a particular non-generic versus either a generic or a different non-generic, it is reasonable to continue to formally prescribe them the thing that they take that is works for them, rather than a generic that may be a batch of something that doesn't work for them or that gives them side effects. So for the patients who seem to need a particular track of thyroxin made by a particular manufacturer, the guidance would suggest that under those circumstances, it's reasonable to continue to prescribe it, even if that prescription, for example, is the liquid formulation rather than the tablet formulation.
I can think of patients who like a particular manufacturer for lots of other medication, but very few that have asked about their levothyroxine. But there are ways that we can prescribe by manufacturer. So it's not different to brand versus generic prescribing. So we can find ways to do that for that small number of patients where that's appropriate. But again, exploring the other underlying reasons is really important as to why they feel like there's something wrong, or that their blood results are changing than they might expect to. So. Super, Marit, thank you very, very much for time. I've got lots of learning points from this and lots of things I'm going to put into practice. Again, I said at the beginning, thyroid disorders, they seem very straightforward to us as GPs, but there are always patients where we can do things better and provide them a better service and actually make sure that they're looked after as best we can. So if we get the basics right, then everyone's happy. Marit, thank you very, very much. And I hope you enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.